Osho, Sufis, the People of the Path, Volume 1. Talks on Sufism given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 6.
The first question. I am not clear. Is being a Sufi a matter of will? Is it a blessing, or is it something else? The Sufis have a very beautiful saying. They say, God is not found by seeking, and never found by those who don't seek. First, a man has to seek, and then he has to surrender his seeking to. Because in the seeking, the seeker goes on existing. The seeker is the ego. Of course, if you never start seeking, you will never find. You have to be thirsty for God. You have to start moving, groping in the dark. But don't become addicted with your groping. A moment comes when you start feeling your will is not succeeding. But that moment comes only through will effort, arduous effort. A moment comes when you start feeling your will has failed, when you are utterly defeated. In that utter defeat is the victory. In that utter defeat, you surrender. In that utter defeat, you start crying. In that utter defeat, you say, now I cannot do any more. I am finished. Whatsoever I could do, I have done. In that moment, when you have this total failure, this feeling of utter defeat, you disappear. You are no more there. The seeker has disappeared. Through seeking. To seek God is to seek the impossible. By seeking you cannot find it. If you can find God by your seeking, then God will be something that you can purchase. Then God will be in your fist. Then God will be your property. Then God will be not greater than you. That which you can seek is bound to be smaller than you. It cannot be bigger than you. The lower cannot seek the higher, and the smaller cannot seek the bigger. You cannot possess the infinite, the eternal. That is absurd. But to understand that this is absurd, one has to start seeking. You will not know it in any other way. One starts longing for God. That means one is moving, desiring, longing for the impossible. That's why I call religion the passion for the impossible. One day or other, defeat is absolutely certain. In that defeat, something transmutes, transforms. In that defeat, the seeker disappears. Will disappears. Surrender happens. You cannot surrender without that defeat. How can you surrender? Deep down you will continue thinking, that I could have succeeded. Or even you may think that this surrender is something that you are doing, that you are the doer of the surrender too. But then it is not surrender. Surrender can happen only in utter defeat. Only utter defeat prepares you to surrender. Not a single hope has remained. Not a single ray of light in the dark night of the soul. You have put everything at stake. Now nothing is left. You are empty. In that emptiness, surrender. That emptiness flowers into surrender. In that emptiness, you are not, something new arrives in. The seeker is no more there. The will has disappeared. But the seeking is there. The longing is there, even more so. Because the energy that was involved in the seeker has also become longing. Now you are simply thirsty, knowing perfectly well that you cannot do anything. That moment of utter despair brings grace. That's what Sufis call barka. What Hindus call prasad. When you have fallen flat and you cannot move even a single inch on your own, you have again become a small child and you are crying and screaming for your mother. The mother comes, but you have to become helpless again. The question is important. You ask, I am not clear. Is being a Sufi a matter of will? Yes, in the beginning, a matter of will. Each journey towards God starts in will, but never ends in will. The first step has to be of will, and will takes you a long way towards your utter defeat. Half the journey is done by willpower, and then the half is done in surrender. Will leads to surrender. This will look paradoxical to you. Will flowers ultimately into surrender, because it is will who makes you aware that on your own you cannot do anything. You have done it. You have seen it fail. So the first step is in will, and the half journey is in the will. And then, when will has disappeared, there is blessing, prasad, barka. So if you ask me, definitely, whether it is will or surrender, I will say it is both and neither. Will and surrender are like two wings of a bird. They both help. They both complement each other. Even while they are opposed to each other, they are complementing. Their very opposition creates movement. Just like your two legs, they are opposed to each other. Through their opposition, energy is created and you can move. Will and power are opposites, but deep down, part of one whole. every seeker starts in will and ends in surrender. The second question, why do great philosophers and so forth say such beautiful things yet remain such a mess? Philosophers are like fences. They run round a lot without getting anywhere at all. Yes, exactly like a fence. It goes on running round and round, but it never reaches anywhere. Thought is a vicious circle. One thought leads into another, and so on and so forth, but you go on moving in a circle. You do a lot of running, but you never reach anywhere. Thought is inconclusive. Thought cannot give you the conclusion. It only pretends. It is a pretender. Conclusion comes through experience. That's why scientists have moved towards the lab, experiment, and the religious mystics have moved towards the inner lab, the experience. Religion is the science of the inner, and science is the religion of the outer. Philosophy is a mess. It is just pure speculation. One sits and thinks without experimenting, without experiencing. And only experience or experiment are conclusive. Experiment is conclusive about the objective world, that which exists opposite to you, the others. And religion is experience, experiment of the inner, of the subjective, that which you are. Both are conclusive. Philosophy is inconclusive. It is an endless game. But philosophers can say beautiful things. In fact, only they can say beautiful things. They can afford to say beautiful things, but they are only sayings. They may have a certain poetry, those statements, but they don't have any reality, any truth. Yes, those statements can be beautiful. They can have a logical consistency, a logical harmony, but they don't relate to reality at all. They are all false. There is nothing to choose between one philosophy and another. All philosophies are false. The philosopher is one who has got stuck with the mind. Man has three layers. First, the body. Second, the mind. Third, the soul. This has to be understood. The soul is a reality. So is the body a reality. Mind is nothing but a bridge between the two. In itself, it has no value. A bridge has no value in itself. It has value only because it bridges the two banks. It has no intrinsic value. The banks can exist without the bridge, but the bridge cannot exist without the banks. It is just an utility, a means. Mind is where soul and body overlap. where body and soul overlap, a new kind of illusory reality is created. That reality is mind. Science trusts in the body. Religion trusts in the soul. Philosophy goes on trusting in the mind. It is a mind game. And remember, when you are totally in your body, mind disappears. Or when you are totally in the soul, mind disappears. If you are making love and you are totally in the body, for a few moments there is no mind. You are so totally involved in the reality of the body, the mind cannot exist. Or, if you are deep in meditation, absolutely in, then too the mind disappears. Reality is always a no-mind thing. Whether you are in the body or in the soul doesn't matter, but reality is always a no-mind thing. Mind is Maya. Mind is illusion. You must have heard the often repeated statement of Vedanta that the world is illusion. That is not exactly right. Because by the world you misunderstand the world of the objects. When Vedanta says the world is illusory, what exactly it means is the mind is illusory. The mind is the world. That is where you live, your world. You don't live in the reality, in the real world. You live in thoughts, desires, fantasies, imaginations. You live in a mind world. That mind is Maya. It is a magical thing. Nothing really exists. It is almost like a dream. Every night you dream, and when you are dreaming, you think that the dream is real. How many times you have been deceived by the dream? When you are going to understand that the dream is not real, and every day in the morning when you are awake, you know that it was not real. And again, you sleep and you dream, and again it becomes real. When you are asleep, the dream appears to be real. The dream appears to be real in the same proportion as you are asleep. If you become a little alert, then the mind is no more real, then the dream is no more real. When one becomes perfectly awakened, when one becomes a Buddha, then the mind is no more real. The morning has come. You have become awakened. That is the meaning of the word Buddha, one who has awakened. Now the body is real, now the soul is real, but mind has disappeared. Mind is a twilight phenomenon. Nikolai Berdyaev says in his autobiography that I am very much afraid of the twilight time. When it is neither day nor night, it frightens me. When I read it, I was puzzled why he should be troubled by the twilight. It is so beautiful. When the day is no more and the night has not come yet. But he is right. He does not mean only the twilight. He means all twilight phenomenon. Mind is a twilight phenomenon. Neither body nor soul. A little reality has been imparted by the soul, and the real reality has been imparted by the body. Mind is borrowed, something of the soul and something of the body. It is just midway. It is neither this nor that. And the philosophy lives in the mind. Hence the philosophy lives in the illusion. Dreams can be beautiful. Illusions can be tremendously sweet. You ask me, why do great philosophers and so forth say beautiful things yet remain such a mess? By saying beautiful things, you cannot sort out the mess. It's not so easy and not so cheap. If you sort out the mess, if you want to get beyond the mess, you will have to do some real work. That's what Gurdjieff used to call. He used to call his system the work. Real work is needed. Beautiful aspirations, poetry, beautiful philosophies can console, but that is not going to help. It is as if somebody is hungry and you go on talking about delicious foods. Somebody is hungry and you give him a menu beautifully printed. Somebody is hungry and you give him a cookbook to read. Exactly that's what philosophy is. Philosophy is a menu. It talks about food, and sometimes it can start your saliva to flow. Even thinking about a lemon, juices starts moving. But that is not going to satisfy. Philosophy affects people because people live in the mind. I have heard a philosopher went to the bus station to catch a bus, but found he was early. He saw a little fortune-telling machine, so he put a nickel in, and a little card came out that said, "You are John Johns. You are 65 years old. You are a great philosopher, and you are on your way to Chicago on a business trip." He said, "I don't believe this machine. I can't believe that this machine knows this information. There must be someone behind it." But he put another nickel in, and another card came out saying, "You are still John Johns. You are still a great philosopher. You are still 65 years old, and you are still going on your way to Chicago on a business trip." "I just don't believe it," said the man again, as he put another nickel in. This time a card came out saying, "You are still John Johns. You are still a great philosopher. You are still 65 years old. You are still on your way to Chicago, but you have fooled around and missed your bus." Philosophy is a fooling around. And mind you, you will miss your bus. Just thinking is not going to help. It is a luxury. You can rest and you can think and you can spin theories. And you can make castles of Spain. And you can dream beautiful dreams. These are all childish. But if you can be logical, if you can be consistent with words, if you have a certain capacity and skill with words, you can feel very much satisfied. You can start feeling that you have the key, that you know. The pet shop delivery boy was not exactly the brightest lad in the world. One day he was asked to deliver a pet rabbit to Mr. Jones, Route 2, Box 4. You had better write that down in case I forget it, said the boy. Slipping the address into his pocket, he started off on his errand. Every few minutes, he glanced at the address and said, I know where I'm going. Mrs. Jones, Route 2, Box 4. Everything went smoothly until he hit a crater in the road. The truck he was driving landed in a ditch and the rabbit began to run for its life across an open field. The boy stood there laughing uproariously. When asked by a passerby what was so funny, he said, did you see that crazy rabbit running across that field? He does not know where he is going because I have got the address in my pocket. All philosophy is like that. It is not concerned with reality. Philosophers think they know the address of God. They don't know. All that know is rubbish. It is all their own fantasy. To know God, one has to become religious. There are only two ways to know the reality. If you are interested in the objective reality, become a scientist. If you are interested in the subjective reality, become religious. That's why philosophy is disappearing by and by. In the future, there is a possibility there may be no philosophy at all. Or it may be only in the madhouses. Science has taken the bigger part of it. Many questions that used to be thought philosophical are no more philosophical. Science has taken them over. They don't have any philosophy about them anymore. Science knows the exact answer. Philosophy can exist only in the twilight, when the exact answer is not known. So major part, the objective part, has been taken over by science. And the another part, the other half, has always been taken by the mystics, the Sufis, the Hasids, the Zen people. Philosophy is dying. It has nothing now to think about. The mystic knows what is reality, and the scientist knows what is objective reality. What is left for the philosopher? There is nothing much left. Philosophy has no future. It had had a glorious past, but it has no future. Out of philosophy, two systems have arisen, which are more relevant: science and religion. Philosophy is a primitive approach, a magical approach. When you don't know anything, you need to think about it. That thinking gives you a kind of substitute. It feels good that at least you know something. Either science will take it away from philosophy or religion will take it away from philosophy. Both are decisive. The future is with science and religion, and the final future will be of a new kind of approach, which will be religio-scientific. The ultimate future will be where science and religion will meet and disappear into a new kind of system, a new kind of synthesis. That will be the greatest day in the history of human consciousness. Just the other night, An old French poet took sannyas. I have given him the name Ananda Kavishwar. It means a great poet of bliss. He was asking me, when the revolution is coming. Of course, he is a French. So thinks in terms of revolution. Though very old, must be beyond 70. But a French, after all, is a French. They don't grow old. When the revolution is coming, I would like to tell him that this is the revolution that I can call real revolution, when science and religion will meet and disappear into one metaphysics, into one synthesis. That will put humanity in a totally new kind of light. That will bring a new harmony into the world. That will help all schizophrenia to disappear. Because body and soul are two realities. Two, I am saying, because still science and religion are separate. In fact, they are not two. The body is the visible soul and the soul is the invisible body. They are not really two, they appear to be two because in between them stands the mind. Once the mind disappears, then the division disappears. Then all demarcation disappears. Then there is no possibility to decide where body ends and where the soul begins. Then they melt and merge into one. That one has been called by Sufis God. Body and soul have disappeared into each other. They don't exist as separate. It is mind just standing in between that keeps them separate, that divides and defines them. Once philosophy is gone, once mind is no more there, who is there to divide the objective from the subjective? Then the outer and the inner will be one. They are one. The outer is the inner, and the inner is the outer. Division disappears, duality disappears. Philosophy is dualistic. That ultimate system for which no name yet exists, or if you allow me, I can use the Indian term darsana, which may become the name for the ultimate synthesis. Darsana is not philosophy as it is ordinarily translated in Indian universities. Books on darsana are called Indian philosophy. It is not true. It is very, very falsifying. Philosophy means love of thinking. Sophia means knowledge, wisdom. And philo means love, love of knowledge. Darsan means not philosophy, but philosia, love to see, not love to think, love to realize, an effort to attain a vision of the ultimate reality as it is. In that ultimate reality, there are no divisions. It is one piece. It is one melody. With that vision, all schizophrenia disappears. Otherwise, man remains divided. When you divide the inner and the outer, you divide man. When you say body, soul, you divide man. And when you divide man, you create conflict. You create tension. And then there is always a war going on inside. I would like you to learn the ways to drop this war, this constant ongoing war. The body is you, and you are the body. Respect your body. Love your body. Respect your soul. Love your soul. And don't create any conflict between the two. Listen silently and you will find their voice is one. With that one voice there is peace, there is benediction. The third question, please explain the difference between following you and surrendering to you. There is a great difference. Following me, you are still on the path of will. Surrendering to me, the will has disappeared. Following me, you are important. You are. This is your decision to follow me. You can change your mind any moment you want. You can cancel your decision. Surrendered to me, you have disappeared. Now it cannot be cancelled. There is nobody to cancel it. Now there is no way to reverse it. Following, it is possibility you may turn back. Surrendering, how can you turn back? It is irreversible. Following me, you are there, I am here. There is bound to be conflict. Surrendering, you disappear. And when you disappear, then you will be able to see that I have never been here. In your disappearance, you will see the disappearance of the master too. A master is a master only because he has already disappeared. He does not function as an ego. So to have a real contact with a master is possible only when you also stop functioning as an ego. That is the meaning of surrender. The master is without any ego. If you want to communicate with him, if you want to be in communion with him, if you want to be in deep love with him, you have to disappear. Only when you also become an emptiness, there will be a meeting. When the disciple is not, suddenly all barriers disappear. If you are, you go on defending. If you are, you go on choosing. If you are, then you will keep a certain space protected, defended. You will keep a fence around you. You will go only so far. The moment you will see that your identity is at stake, you will turn back. The moment you will say, now you can be completely taken over, you will start moving away. You will go only to a certain extent, defending yourself, remaining yourself. This is not the way to be a disciple. A follower is not a disciple. A follower is convinced through his intellect that the whatsoever the teacher is saying seems to be logically right. It is convincing. It is intellectually satisfying. That's what a follower is. A follower is from the head. And the disciple? A disciple is not only intellectually convinced that the master is right in what he says. The disciple is convinced that the master is right, not in what he says, but in what he is. It is a heart-to-heart approach. It is a dialogue, deeper than the head. Two beings communing. The disciple surrenders. And the beauty is, very paradoxical it is. The beauty is, when you surrender to a master for the first time, you become yourself. Because surrendering to the outer master is really surrendering to the inner master. Everybody is carrying somewhere deep in the innermost core of one's being, God. God is present in you, but you don't know how to approach. You have forgotten ways and means how to come to your own inner reality. You have lost the key and locked the door. And it has been centuries that you have never been in. You don't know how to turn in. You have become paralyzed. You can see only outside. Hence the outer master is needed. The outer master will only help you to go to your inner master. The outer master will become a door. You have to go via the outer master because you cannot go directly. If you can go directly, there is no need for a master. Few people, very rare it happens, go without a master. Yes, sometimes it happens. Sometimes it happens, a person reaches directly into his being. But it is very rare. It is so exceptional that it can be counted out. It is so exceptional that it only proves the rule. Hence, no tradition, Sufis, Zain, Hasid, no tradition talks about it. They all insist a master is needed. Why they don't talk about it? Don't they know about it? They know. It has happened. Few times it has happened down the centuries. A man has attained to his self without going via the outer master. He has reached directly to his innermost core. But why they don't talk? People think Krishnamurti is talking about it for the first time. People think Krishnamurti is very original about it. That is not the case. All the masters have known about it, but they have not talked about it for a certain reason. The reason is that if it is told to you that you can go by your own, then this very statement will become a barrier in your surrendering. And only one in a million can go. What about the remaining? They will also think they can also go. What is the need to surrender? Their ego will exploit the idea. Their ego will say, then it is perfectly okay. Why should I surrender to anybody? I can go myself. To protect these fools, it has never been said before. Krishnamurti is not saying anything new. It has been known always. It is one of the oldest, ancient, most truths that sometimes a rare person enters. But it is accidental. It cannot be made a rule. And to talk about it is dangerous. Because the egoist will fall upon it, immediately will jump upon it. That's why around Krishnamurti you will find all kinds of egoistic people. One who cannot surrender will sooner or later reach Krishnamurti. One who is not able to surrender, whose ego is really very harsh and does not want to surrender, will be very happy with Krishnamurti. Of course, that happiness is not going to change him. Many people come to me, they say, we have been with Krishnamurti for 30 years, 40 years, we have been listening and reading, and whatsoever he says is perfectly true. What do you say about him? I say, he is saying the truth, but he is talking to fools. It is the truth, but he should not have told it to you. They feel very offended. Why? If it is the truth, then why he should not tell to us? 40 years are lost, and even maybe 40 more lives in future. What you have attained? They become restless. They say, I have not attained anything. But is it not the truth? It is the truth, but you are not ready for it. A truth is truth only when you can use it. It has to be in such a way that it is helpful. Buddha has said that by truth only one thing is meant, that it works. If it works, it is true. If it doesn't work, what is the meaning of calling it truth? It is inhuman. Krishnamurti's truth has not worked. It cannot work. It can work only in a rare case. And the person with whom it can be of any use will not bother to come to Krishnamurti. Why he should bother? He can go directly. Why he should come via Krishnamurti? These people who are surrounding Krishnamurti are still in need of somebody and is still so egoistic that they cannot surrender. So this is a good support for their ego. They need not surrender and they can have a master. But you cannot have a master without surrendering. Krishnamurti is a master without disciples. Those disciples cannot surrender. His own teaching prohibits them to surrender. He has lived a very lonely life. And sometimes he gets very angry. Angry that his whole life has been a wastage. Buddha helped thousands. Thousands became enlightened. Not only while Buddha was alive, even when Buddha was gone, the chain continued, the silsila continued, the continuum has remained. Even now, here and there a flower blooms and bows down in deep gratitude towards Buddha after 2,500 years. Still. And Krishnamurti is the man of the same caliber as Buddha. Is the man of the same intelligence as Buddha. Nothing is lacking. But just this idea that the disciple need not surrender. And a truth is still dangerous. It has allowed only people, egoistic people, to come around him. Those who would like to surrender will not come to him because he won't allow surrender. Those who don't want to surrender and are in search still of a master, they cannot depend on their own and they cannot surrender. These people have gathered around. Now they are stuck. Krishnamurti is stuck with them and they are stuck with Krishnamurti. Krishnamurti cannot say surrender. And the day Krishnamurti will say surrender, they will escape. Because they are there only because he goes on saying there is no need to surrender to anybody. They are feeling perfectly good, very happy with this idea. Their ego need not be at stake. But nothing is happening. I have come across many. Nothing is happening. They have become very, very intellectual, very refined intellectuals. They can talk a lot. They can discuss and argue a lot. But nothing has happened. No fragrance has happened. The ego won't allow. You ask me, please explain the difference between following you and surrendering to you. One who is following me is not with me. Remember. He may be using me, but he is not with me. He may be choosing few things from me, but he remains the decisive factor. Deep inside, he is still defending himself. He may find few bits and few pieces of wisdom, but they are not going to help. They will become a philosophy. Only those who are surrendered to me are with me. And only those who are with me, I can be with them. If you are not with me, it is impossible for me to be with them, even though I would like, but it is impossible. It is not possible in the nature of things. If you are surrendered, only then I can be with you. Only then you are available, receptive. That's what sannyas is all about. Drop following and move into surrender. Sannyas is surrender. The day you take sannyas, if you have really taken it from your heart, you are no more. Then you become part of me. Or I become part of you. Then you breathe for me, or I breathe for you. Then you don't think about yourself as separate entities. And the paradox is that you don't become dependent. For the first time, you become independent individuals. Because the ego is not the thing that makes you independent. Ego is a prison, an ugly prison. When the ego has gone for the first time, your flame burns bright. The third question, why does religion create so much guilt? Religion does not create guilt. And if it creates, it is not religion. Yes, Mohammedanism, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, they create guilt. Let that be your definition of a religion. If it creates guilt, it is not a religion. Something else pretending. Something else garbed as religion. Posing as religion, but not religion. Religion creates celebration, not guilt. These are hidden things which don't want to expose themselves. These so-called religions are more political than religious. Their whole idea, a desire, ambition, is how to dominate people, is how to control people. And naturally, guilt is one of the best mechanisms ever evolved to control people, to dominate people, make them feel guilty. Once they start feeling guilty, they are in your control. All dictators do that. All politicians do that. And your priest is just a politician behind a mask. The Pope, the Shankaracharya, these are all politicians. They are not religious people. They have a very hidden politics. The politics is how to dominate humanity, how to control people, how to make slaves out of people. And of course, there is no better trick than creating guilt. It is a psychological technique. How it functions? To create guilt, first you have to create an impossible ideal. Give an impossible ideal which cannot be fulfilled, which is inhuman, which is not possible at all. For example, in India they have created guilt about sex. If you have any sex desire, you start feeling like a great sinner. Sex has been condemned. Now, sex is such a natural thing, as natural as any other thing, eating, breathing. One thing is only different about sex, that it can be transcended. But there is nothing intrinsically wrong about it. One can go beyond it. And when one goes beyond it, there is great freedom. There is great joy. Greater than the sex can ever bring. But still, sex is not sin. Sex is beautiful, healthy. But if it is condemned, then you have a great trick, a great technique in your hands. Millions of people will be controlled through it, because they will not be able to get beyond it. In fact, the more they think it is a sin, the less is the possibility to go beyond it. Because to go beyond, one has to go through. So a very cunning way to keep people in sexuality and keep them feeling guilty, and continuously they are afraid that they are doing something wrong. When a person feels that I see he is doing something wrong, he is trembling inside. He cannot be a rebel. He cannot stand on his own. He knows he is guilty. He is not good. He is not worthy enough of anything. He cannot hope to be happy. He knows he is a sinner. Hell is waiting for him. Now you can manipulate. You can do whatever you want to do with this man. He is available. He is ready to become a slave. This is a psychological slavery. You have taken his respect for himself. You have taken away his worth. He feels himself dirty. How can he love himself? How can he respect himself? He will be a victim to anybody who wants to control him. The parents will control him. The wife will control him. The husband will control. Children will control. The society will control. Everybody will control him. Because something immensely valuable has been destroyed in him. His respect for himself. He has lost that. And he will remain miserable, continuously miserable. How can you be happy if you don't have any respect for yourself? And such a natural thing as sex, and so difficult to get rid of it. Yes, people can transcend, but nobody can get rid of it. Let me tell you something. Just the other day I was reading psychologist Dr. Paul Cameron reports, that males spend a great deal of time thinking about sex. In a survey of 4,000 people, he found that males between the ages of 12 and 17 think about sex once every 2 minutes. This rate continues into young adulthood and drops to once every 5 minutes in middle age, that is 40 to 45, and finally tails off to once every 10 minutes after 65. Females give thought to sex every 2.5 minutes as teenagers. They are a little more saintly. Half minute difference. Once every 3 minutes in young adulthood. Once every 10 minutes in middle age, 40 to 45. And once every 20 minutes after 65. And that too, to me, seems just because of conditioning. Because the females down the ages have been conditioned more than the males against sex. They were expected to remain virgins. That too is male ego. Why? Why you should try to find a virgin to get married to? Why? The male ego. The male ego always wants to be there first. Everywhere. To be the first. Hence the woman has to remain a virgin. And boys are boys. Virginity was not expected of boys, but girls were very much protected. Women have been more repressed. But out of thousands of years of repression, only half minute difference. Not much. So, ladies, please, don't feel too much saintly. But this survey is very important. It shows how natural sex is. Now, if you create guilt, if you make people feel that this is sin, you are destroying their respect for themselves. And you are making them afraid. And the so-called religions make you afraid that you will suffer in hell, and they make you also greedy that you will have your rewards in heaven if you follow their dictates. So greed and fear. And between the two is created guilt. When the father of Sirhan, the assassin of Senator Robert Kennedy, was asked why your son did it and how he could do it, the old man said, "I just don't know. I am crushed and confused. I taught my children to fear God." The man said, "I taught my children to fear God, so I am very much confused how he could do such an ugly, ghostly act, such a horrible thing." But the old man does not know that fear of God is not a good thing. Precisely it is because of the fear that he could do such a thing. If you are too much afraid, If you are too much afraid of being yourself, then there are two possibilities. Either you become a so-called false saint. You pretend to be that which you are not. Or you become a criminal. You assert whatsoever is the case. But in both the ways, you become abnormal. Fear creates abnormality. Either you become a saint, the so-called saint, the Mahatma, a hypocrite, or you become a criminal. It depends how you will react. If you are a cowardly man, you will become a Mahatma. And if you are a brave man, you will become a criminal. But both are wrong. Neither cowardly saints and hypocrites are needed, and nor brave criminals are needed. Brave saints are needed. Courageous saints are needed. That is a totally different thing. You cannot create that out of fear. And for small things, man has been made so much afraid. Listen to this story. There was a young English boy by the name Ori. He was of a home of very meager circumstances. Nights when they did not have enough food for supper, they resorted to a dish known as sparrow pie. He was met at the back door by his mother one day, and she told him to go for some sparrows for sparrow pie. The best way to hunt them was to go to a group of trees in a cemetery. Late in the evening, he crept carefully up and was ready to make a mighty sweep with a big stick, when suddenly he fell into a freshly dug grave, as yet unoccupied. He tried to get out, but it had rained, and the sides were as slick as glass. He knew his mother would send someone for him, and she did, his big brother. But just as he got near the grave, another terrible thing happened. His brother also fell into the grave. It was dark, and he did not know he was not alone. So he pushed and sobbed, but it had rained in his end of the grave as much as in the other end. And the harder he pushed and sobbed, the harder he fell to the bottom. Young Uri had enjoyed the sow, but knew that all good things must come to an end. So he decided to make as much of the dramatic situation as possible. He sat up very straight in his end of the grave, gathered all the diaphragmic tones well underneath him, and with all the eerie, ghastly tones he could muster, he said, "Friend, can't you let a man rest in peace?" There was a deadening silence in his end of the grave. Then something that resembled a rocket zoomed by old Iri's head, and his brother, who had not been able to make 6 feet to the top of the grave, made 20 feet past it on his first jump. Fear works. Priests came to know it very early. Fear works. Create fear, and then you can make people do anything you want to. Fear creates such an intensity that one puts his whole life at the stake. You go in the monasteries, it is fear that people are in the monasteries, is struggling hard with sex, with food, with his sleep. It is just fear, fear of hell, or greed, which is another aspect of the same thing. Greed and fear are two aspects of the same coin. A greedy person is an afraid person, and a fearful person is a greedy person. A really courageous man has no greed and no fear. He lives his nature in a natural way. A prominent politician, when he was a candidate for an important municipal office, said to three Negroes that he would give a fat turkey to the one who would give the best reason for being a Republican. The first one said, "I is a Republican because the Republican sought us darkies free." "Very good, Peter," said the politician. "Now, Bill, let me hear from you." "Well, I is a Republican because they done give us the protective tariff." "Fine," exclaimed the politician. "Now, Sam, what do you have to say?" "Boss," said Sam, scratching his head and shifting from one foot to the other. "Boss, I is a Republican because I wants that turkey." People are religious either out of fear or out of greed. But people are not religious out of awareness or out of love. And all these religions who have created guilt in man have created an irreligious world. Beware. Because in you also, the same mechanism has been put. Everybody carries inside him guilt. As if you are naturally wrong. That to be natural is to be wrong. Anger is wrong, sex is wrong, joy in food is wrong, laughter is wrong. All good things seems to be wrong. And then one goes on repressing. And howsoever you repress, nature goes on asserting. You repress it and it asserts. When it asserts and you have to do something against your mind, then guilt. Then you know that you have fallen again. You have committed the sin again. Be free from guilt. If you really want to go closer to God, be free from guilt. Accept nature. Welcome it. It is perfectly good. Sex is good. Sometimes anger is good. When I say sometimes, I mean whenever anger is spontaneous, it is good. And if you allow anger its spontaneity, you will never accumulate anger. And you will not explode out of proportions. And your system will be clean. It will be a momentary thing. Something happens and you respond. And if your anger is spontaneous, relevant, responsible, true to the moment, is not a reaction but a response, it has beauty. You simply say that you are alive, nothing else. But if you go on repressing your anger, feeling that anger is wrong, don't do it. When you are feeling angry, smile, go on smiling. You are gathering poison. And after a time, there comes a limit. When the poison is too much and will explode. And will explode in such a situation where you will look foolish, stupid, mad. Because the situation had never demanded it. Have you not observed it? When you really become angry, out of repression, you are always irrelevant. Your response is not to the point. It comes from the past. For example, for many days you have been repressing anger in the office, in the marketplace, with the friends, in the club. Then one day suddenly, it breaks through on your child. You hit him hard. And you pretend you are doing it for his own good. And you know that he has been just an excuse. That poor child is suffering from your anger absolutely unnecessary. And the child can see that he has not done anything, not at least in the proportion that you are being hard with him. And you know that in the face of the child, you have projected the face of your boss, you have projected the face of your wife, you have projected so many faces and so many situations. Now the poor child is a victim. This anger is ugly. And this anger comes because you have been taught that anger is wrong. Never be angry. All that is spontaneous is beautiful. And I am not saying there are not states of consciousness where anger disappears. But it disappears only by being spontaneous. Anger, greed, fear, sex, all disappear. A moment comes, slowly, slowly, when you have experienced life in its truth, in its reality. When you have lived it in all its possibilities, you grow beyond it. Then those things become toys left behind. They look childish, immature, juvenile. Not that you condemn them, and not that now you hope that you will get to heaven. There is nothing in it. You have not sacrificed anything. There is no sacrifice. Mr. Khrushchev wanted to find out what people really thought of him. Naturally, they would not tell him if they recognized him. So he dressed in an elaborate disguise, put on glasses and a false mustache, and flew to a small town in the Urals. There he met a farmer and said, "Tell me, what do you think of Khrushchev?" The farmer answered, "Shh, you crazy or something?" He looked around furtively and took the premier inside his farmhouse. He closed all the windows, bolted the doors, pulled down the shades, then whispered, "I like him." This is the situation of man. So much fear. So much fear has been put in your system, in your blood, in your very mother's milk. It has gone into you. You have been brought up in fear. If you really want to be with me, drop guilt. And the same energy that has become the complex of guilt, once released, becomes celebration. Celebration is the right attitude. Celebrate all that God has given to you. And I promise you that if you can celebrate all that God has given to you, you will become worthy of more. Sex disappears one day and you become capable of love. And one day love disappears and you become capable of prayer. And one day prayer disappears and you become a god yourself. But one has to start to live that which has been given to you. I have heard Sister Agnes was walking through the park near the convent when she was attacked and raped several times by her assailant. Hearing of her horrible misfortune, the Mother Superior hurried to the hospital and met the doctor on duty. "Ah, doctor, how is poor Sister Agnes?" "She is doing fine," said the MD. They should be through with the plastic surgery in a few hours. What? Exclaimed the Mother Superior. Why in God's name would she need plastic surgery? We are trying to get the smile off her face. That's what your so-called religions have done to people. Repression, repression, repression. They have not allowed you to be yourself, to be a natural being. They have crippled you, paralyzed you. Of course, it is easy to control paralyzed people. It is easy to control crippled people. It is easy to dominate dead people. People who enjoy their life are difficult to control. It will be difficult if people are really living their sex life truly to send them to war. It will be impossible. Why? A man who is immensely satisfied, why he should go to war? Because some stupid politicians are fighting on some stupid problems where the boundary should be of one country, few miles here or few miles there. For these stupid things, can you convince people to go and die? You cannot. If they are really living their life, they will laugh at the whole ridiculousness of it. Why? But right now it is just the opposite. People are so ready to go to war because they are dead. War gives them a feeling of life, at least some thrill. They are so bored. Bored with the wife, bored with the husband, bored with the children, bored with the whole thing that is so-called life. War brings a little joy. People feel happy when there is war. You can see a subtle joy on the face of the soldiers going to the war. You can see all around thrill, adventure. Why? Their life is so dull that even death in comparison seems to be far better. If people's life is a celebration, you cannot drive people to war. For no foolish reasons, ideological, religious, you cannot drive people to war. They will simply refuse. They will laugh at the whole nonsense of it. You cannot force people to do ugly jobs. Jobs that simply destroy their soul. But dead people can be forced anywhere. You can make a man a clerk, and his whole life he will simply put files from here and there. The whole life he will sift files. There will be no joy in his life. But a guilty person cannot expect more. Even this is too much. It is a God's blessing that he is employed. Dead people will go on living. A man will go on sleeping with a woman he does not love. He is so guilty, he feels it a God's blessing, even he has got a woman, that's okay. A woman will go on living with a man she hates, feels repelled. Guilty people can be forced into any hole, into any dungeon. But when people are happy, they will live their life. When they are happy, they will become woodcutters, gardeners, farmers, fishers. They will be singers, dancers, poets, painters. Or if somebody enjoys being a clerk, that is another thing. then he chooses it. But that is his choice. And people will not be so mad after money. Money is a substitute for love. When you don't get love, you start trying to have more money, more money. Money is a substitute for love. That's why people who are very miserly about money are very loveless people. They cannot afford to be loving. If they are loving, they cannot be miserly. Both things don't go together. A loving person is never a miser. And a miser is never a loving person. He need not love. His love is money. His God is money. He worships money. That's enough. Then there are power addicts who go on their whole life trying to get more and more powerful. How to reach to New Delhi or Washington or Moscow? Their whole life seems to be just an effort to reach to the capital. For what? Why people enjoy power so much? Why this madness, this political madness? The reason is they don't have any power over themselves. They need a substitute. They can feel happy if they have power over others. A man who has power over himself need not bother. Why he should bother to have power over others? It is enough. It is more than enough that he has power over himself. That's why in India we call a sannyasin swami. Swami means one who has power over himself. His whole search is that I should be myself. It is enough, it is immensely satisfying that I am a master of my own self. That's enough. Why you bother to be master of others? But people are missing that basic mastery. Hence, they are driven in mad ways, in mad paths. Politics, money, power, prestige, fame. These are all ugly things. These are neurotic things. And religions have not only condemned it, they have created a subtle mechanism to condemn you from yourself. The priest cannot follow you everywhere. The parents cannot go with you everywhere. So they have created a very subtle mechanism. Almost like an electrode of Delgado, they have put a conscience in you that goes on condemning. If the parents have said, don't make love to this woman, she is not yet your wife, and love is prohibited, you may go alone with the woman. It may be a full moon night, and you may be feeling like loving, and she may be feeling like loving. And the parents are no more there. They are far away, miles far away, maybe dead. But the conscience, deep in your heart, somebody goes on pulling, don't do this, this is wrong. Even if you do it, you will not enjoy it, because the parents will go on interfering. If you don't do it, you will be miserable. If you do it, you will be miserable. Either way, you will be miserable. I have heard parents nowadays, particularly in America, are too busy even to punish their kids. Mothers are running to bingo games. Fathers are running off to golf courses and bowling alleys. And mothers have their boyfriends and fathers have their girlfriends. Before they leave the house, they just say, son, we left a strap on the bed. If you do something wrong, hit yourself 6 times. That may not be done actually like that, but that is what conscience tries to do. Hit yourself. Whenever you do something thought to be wrong, hit yourself. Punish yourself. This is the most criminal act to do with a child. To create a policeman in him, against himself. That's what conscience is. My whole effort here is to kill your policeman. And I'm not saying become irresponsible. And I'm not saying go mad or insane. I'm saying be freed of the policeman. Rather than having a conscience, have consciousness, which is the true thing. Let consciousness decide, not conscience. Conscience is borrowed. It is parental. It is societal. It is political. A man who has a conscience is never a free man. He is a slave. He is not inside a prison, but the prison is inside him. The prison is there inside him. The jailer is sitting there just in his own heart, pulling his strings. Drop this policeman, say goodbye to it forever. Become more alert, become more loving, become more natural, become more ordinary. Drop ideals. Don't try to be extraordinary. That's how you have been befooled. And don't try to become perfect images of something which does not exist in reality. Don't try to become a Christ or a Buddha or a Krishna. Just try to become yourself. That's what God wants you to be. If he wanted Buddhas, he would have created all the Buddhas. He never creates again. Once is enough. He has created you as a unique human being. Respect this unique human being that you are and live it authentically. Drop all guilt, fear, greed. Enjoy each moment of life as a great blessing from God, a barakah. The last question. What is wrong in studying religious scriptures? Who will be studying? You will be studying. When you read a statement of Jesus, who will interpret it to you? You will interpret it. The statement will no more be of Jesus. It will become yours. You will have pulled it down to your level. How can you read scriptures unless you attain to that consciousness out of which the scripture has flowed? If you want to understand Krishna, his Gita, you will have to attain to Krishna consciousness. There is no other way. Otherwise you will corrupt the scripture. When I say, please burn the scriptures, I am not against the scriptures, I am trying to save them. Otherwise you will corrupt them. If you want to understand Jesus, you will have to attain Christ consciousness. At least a little bit. A little window opens in your heart that gives you a vision of the sky that was fully available to Jesus. Only then. Otherwise, you will go on interpreting in your own way. That's what is happening always. Rather than learning the word, learn the ways of being more conscious. The young convert worked as a clerk in a store, operated on strictly Christian principles. One day, an elegant lady came in to buy some tapestry. Producing a roll from the lowest shelf, he said, "This is $198 a yard, madam." "Young man, I can offer the very best, and I want the very best," the prospective customer declared. "Well, this is $298 a yard," said the clerk, producing the most expensive price range they had in fabrics. "Young man, I don't think you understand. I want the very best," the customer said emphatically. The clerk reached for another roll of $298 quality material. We have this one at $998 a yard, he said. Fine, responded the customer. That is just what I want. The owner came into the store later and was told of the transaction. But how can you reconcile a deal with such as that with scripture? He asked, because the store was run strictly on Christian principles. Scratching his head, the young man replied, she was a stranger and I took her in. He is quoting scripture. Or this beauty. It was somewhat disconcerting to the minister's wife to hear him exclaim, ah, Jesus, sweet Jesus, every time he reached Argas. And she finally asked him about it. It is perfectly proper, my dear, and in accordance with the Bible. He answered her, don't you remember where it says, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord? Enough for today.